Hi, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be here with so many of you tonight, beginning learning in preparation of Tisha B'Av and thinking about the ideas related to the 3 weeks. It's an honor to have been asked by the CJF to do this, and I give my Hakaras HaTov to them. Just a little bit about myself. I'm currently the campus Rebbetzin at the Barron campus at Stern College for Women, as well as a Tanakh teacher at the Stella K. Abraham High School for Girls in Long Island. We are going to begin learning tonight a little bit about Megillat Icha. I'm going to share my screen right now with many of the sources that we'll be looking at tonight. We'll be spending tonight discussing the topic, the theme of what are we mourning? When we begin learning Megillat Icha, what are we supposed to be focusing on? What was the purpose that Megillat Icha was written? What's the mindset that it's supposed to put us in as we think about these upcoming few weeks and Tisha B'Av itself? And we'll be focusing primarily on Prakim, Aleph, and Bet, the first two Prakim of Megillat Icha, which we'll see in a moment, is actually not even called Megillat Icha in a technical sense. The Gemara Bav Batra tells us that Yirmiyahu katav sifro v'sefer malachim v'kino. That Yirmiyahu Anavi wrote his own sefer, meaning sefer Yirmiyahu, sefer malachim, and kino. The Gemara explains that kino is actually what we refer to very commonly as Megillat Icha. Kinnot is the technical name that the Gemara uses when describing our Megillah. I think many of you just finished a shiur with Rabbi Ram about Yirmiyahu and about Sefer Yirmiyahu, and I think an interesting thing to think about in terms of the series for tonight is the connections between Sefer Yirmiyahu and Megillat Icha. I very often like to say that in many ways, Sefer Yirmiyahu is the book that tells us all that led up to the Chorban, as well as what actually happened at the time of the Chorban, whereas Kinos, Eicha, is in essence the emotional diary that Yirmiyahu gives us in understanding how he, as a Navi, after so many years felt after finally witnessing the Chorban, which he had worked so hard to prevent. We're going to begin tonight's shiur with an overview of Megillat Eicha through the lens of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik begins in his famous work, The Lord is Righteous in All of His Ways, which is written after his death. He asks the question as to what exactly Eicha means. We refer to this Megillah very frequently as Eicha, and he asks, what does Eicha mean? And he explains, Eicha means how or why. But more broadly, how is it possible? How could you have done it? Why did you do it? I don't understand. Right? When a person says Eicha, he's not only asking how could it be or why could it be, but he's asking much more serious questions than that. How is it possible that something like this happened? How is it possible that HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed his home? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroy his home? But says Rav Soloveitchik, asking these questions raises a very serious question. What right do we as human beings have to say kino, to ask these questions and to complain? Says Rav Soloveitchik, who am I to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to explain anything to me? And what he says is that on Tisha B'Av itself, we have the right to ask these questions. We have the right to ask, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu did you do this? Why would you have done such a thing? Why would you have gone to these lengths to inflict destruction and difficulty upon us? But what Rav Soloveitchik explains is that our right as individuals living in 5780 in 2020, comes from the precedent set for by us, by Yirmiyahu. A special license is granted to Knesset Yisrael that allows them to ask Eicha on Tisha B'Av, because Yirmiyahu wrote a book in the biblical canon that begins with the word Eicha. Sefer Eicha is not only the introduction to the keynote, but rather it is keynote. Meaning that we spend our entire experience on Tisha B'Av sitting on the floor asking serious, powerful questions. How, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, over these thousands of years have we as a Jewish people gone through so many tragedies? How could that be? Why? How could you have done that to us? And the importance of this work, of keynote, of Megillat Eicha, is the fact that it tells us that we have the opportunity and the right on Tisha B'Av to ask those questions. That Megillat Eicha, Sefer Eicha, is not only our introduction to the keynote, and that we read it right before we go into the keynote on the eve of Tisha B'Av, but rather it in and of itself is keynote. It is the basis for all of the keynotes that have followed afterwards. Soloveitchik continues and explains the reason for why on Tisha B'Av we have the right to ask these questions is that the mourning for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was considered to be so overwhelming that the prophet or any other human being for that matter was given unlimited freedom to ask, even though the question would have been inappropriate and highly so in the context of any other event. That because Churban Beis HaMikdash was so intense, was so overwhelming for Yirmiyahu and for Klal Yisrael at the time, because of that, we're given the freedom to ask these questions. That while these questions might have been inappropriate in other contexts, Churban Beit HaMikdash was such a difficult, destructive, saddening event that it gave Klal Yisrael the ability to ask these deep questions. This basis of trying to use Tisha B'Av as a moment of understanding is elaborated on by Rav Soloveitchik in the continuation of this chapter by saying that Tisha B'Av is not only a day of crying. It's not only a day where we sit on the floor until Chatzot. It's not only a day where we say we're crying over all of the destruction and tragedy and suffering that has taken place throughout our years, throughout the past 2,000 years. But says Rav Soloveitchik, it is an intelligent cry, an understanding of the catastrophe and especially of the fallout of the catastrophe. That it's a time that not only are we supposed to sit and cry, which is emotional, but it's a time where we're supposed to think about it. It's a time where we're supposed to contemplate as to what had happened and to its impacts on us throughout the centuries. And he says, and especially of the fallout of that catastrophe. He continues to say, and that fallout is still continuing. The event of the Churban was like an atomic bomb. First there was an explosion, and then there is the fallout, which may last for thousands of years. This is the Churban. First the event itself, and then the fallout. The fallout being the total experience of the Jew in the last two millennia. And this total experience, says the Rav, is explained through the study of Eicha and through the medium of the many teachings of Chazal and the keynote that we recite on the morning of Tisha B'Av. When I was learning this Sefer by Rav Soloveitchik, which we have right over here, if you don't have it, I strongly recommend you get it. It will definitely, I would say, enhance your understanding of the day. I began to think more deeply of about what exactly Tisha B'Av is. And I'll say as we approach Shiva Sar B'Tamidz, which begins tomorrow night, there's something that takes effort to get into what exactly this time period is all about. It's not something that comes immediately. And as I began to read these texts and began to learn Megillat Eicha anew this year, began to hit me of how much this experience, this story that we're going to read, this text that we're going to learn together that was written by Yirmiyahu so many years ago has completely impacted the Jewish experience over the last two millennia. It has transformed the experience of the Jew. And that experience begins to be explained through our study of Eicha, says the Rav. That in order to understand that event, that explosion, that catastrophe that completely changed the makeup of Klal Yisrael until today, we learn Megillat Eicha. We study Megillat Eicha, and from there we study Megillat Eicha as the basis for understanding the many teachings of Chazal, of the keynote that they wrote. In many ways they mimic Megillat Eicha, and in many ways they elaborate on Eicha, and in many ways they add to our understanding of what exactly the day is. So as an introduction, we walk into our study of Eicha with the recognition that this is the text that allows us the ability to ask those deep questions, that allows us the ability to question HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how, why? It gives us the opportunity to really feel that mourning. I think as we read through some of the psukim, they're extremely impactful, and in many ways they're very intense. And I think as we learn through the psukim together, we'll begin to get ourselves into what he calls that intelligent crying, of what it means to truly understand this catastrophe. And in many ways, hopefully by the end of this series, we'll have a fuller understanding as to the fallout of that catastrophe and how we can try to get back to where we once were. Megillat Eicha, as many of us know, the first four prakim of Megillat Eicha, as the Rav says in this first line, follow the order of the Aleph Bet. The first pasuk begins with Aleph, the second pasuk begins with the letter Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav. That is the structure of Prakim Aleph, Bet, and Dalet. Perek Gimel actually is written a little bit differently. It's three Alephs, three Bets, three Gimels, three Dalets. But as we begin our study of Megillat Eicha together, the first question that we have to understand is why? Why did Yirmiyahu HaNavi, when he was thinking about a structure of how am I going to write this text? How am I going to write this text that's going to reflect the intensity of this experience? Why did Yirmiyahu HaNavi choose to write this text in this way and in this order? I want to say that there's actually two different, I want to share, that there's actually a few different opinions, the Ibn Ezra on the one hand, many of the other Parshanim on the other hand, the Malbim being one of them, of course, much later on, that there are two different opinions as to when exactly Megillat Eicha was written. Some say Yirmiyahu HaNavi actually wrote it prior to the Chorban, perhaps as a nevuah, perhaps as a way of telling Klal Yisrael, you know, this is going to happen. Some say it actually was written after the Chorban. Some say some combination of the few, and we'll get into more of that as we learn these prakim together. But I think the major question that we have to grapple with before we even dive into the text of the Megillah is the understanding of why exactly Yirmiyahu HaNavi wrote the Megillah in this fashion. So Rav Soloveitchik offers an analysis based on many different other prakim in Tanakh that are also written with this structure. One of them that's probably very familiar to us is Ashrei, the structure of Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav. And he offers the following approach. By singing a hymn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged in accordance with the alphabet, or by saying Vidoy in accordance with the alphabet, something we do on many fast days, something that we do on Yom Kippur, I emphasize one thing, that I have no language. I humbly acknowledge that conventional language is simply inadequate for my task. When we read a text, a Jewish text, that has the structure of Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav, Rav Soloveitchik says, it's to emphasize to us that we don't have the ability to convey actually what we're feeling. That when we're trying to actually praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a parak of Tehillim, and we say it in the order of Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav, it's with the recognition that I can't really praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu fully. He's so much greater than what I'm saying here. So I'm going to use the alphabet as my structure. The same thing with Vidoy. We use the alphabet as our structure with the recognition that it probably doesn't encompass all of the sins that we've actually done, but that it's a structure for providing us with the opportunity to do that. The same thing here with Eicha, says Rav Soloveitchik. It's inadequate. The language, there is not enough language to describe what this Chorban was. And he continues and says, it shows that the catastrophe was so great and the disaster so terrible that even if he, meaning Yirmiyahu, had used up all of his words, his entire vocabulary, he would have been unable to express the fullness of his despondence and distress, his sadness and his grief. That using Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, etc., all the way through Tav, was a literary technique that Yirmiyahu used to show us that even that which we experience by learning through these psukim and by learning through this Megillah, even that doesn't fully encapsulate the experience, doesn't fully encapsulate the sadness and grief that Klal Yisrael went through at the time. It doesn't fully encapsulate the catastrophe that took place. It is a structure to at least give us a sense, a tamtzit, a little bit of what exactly he was feeling and what exactly he was trying to express. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Dalet and Aleph gives us two additional approaches. Amar Rava Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mipnei Malakhu Yisrael Be'icha. Rava, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, asked the question as to why exactly Klal Yisrael were bemoaned with the term Eicha. Says Rabbi Yochanan, Mipnei She'avru Al Shloshim V'Sheish Kritot She'betorah. Because Klal Yisrael violated 36 prohibitions that had Isser Karit. Isser Karit being one of the punishments handed down by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, one of the most intense punishments that we don't necessarily always know when one receives it or how exactly it plays out. But that the word Eicha, the gematria of the word Eicha, Aleph being 1, Yud being 10, Chaf being 20, and Hey being 5, is the equivalent of 36. That Klal Yisrael disobeyed, violated 36 prohibitions, performs 36 Averot each, which had the Isser Karet attached to it. And therefore, the Megillah starts off by referencing to us with this Aleph, Eicha Yashva Badad. But in order to really answer our question as to why exactly Aleph Bet, Rabbi Yochanan says the following. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, in very basic language, and I think it's an extremely powerful answer. Mipnei lakhu ba'aleph bet. Why was our plight bemoaned with an aleph bet? Mipnei she'avru al ha-Torah shenitna ba'aleph bet. Because we transgressed the Torah that was given to us in the language of the aleph bet. Meaning that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us this Torah. And our job as Jews and as being the Jewish people is to guard and keep that Torah, to perform its mitzvah. And yet, what did Klal Yisrael do prior to the Churban? And honestly, there's a Gemara that says that every generation that doesn't have the Beis HaMikdash, it's Ke'ilu, it was Necharav in their time. It's Ke'ilu, it was destroyed in their time. Rabbi Yochanan says very powerfully that because we didn't keep this Torah that was performed, that was given to us in the language of the alphabet, we're going to encapsulate the destruction that came in that same Aleph Bet language as well. That it's appropriate that because we transgressed that which was given to us in the Aleph Bet, therefore we're going to be punished. What we did is going to be bemoaned. What we did is going to be articulated in the same language of the Aleph Bet. With that in mind, with those two approaches of understanding the structure of the Megillah, of the fact that each of the first four prakim are in the structure of Aleph Bet, Gimel, Dalet, etc., we move into Perek Aleph. Rav Soloveitchik explains to us that in the first chapter of Eicha, the prophet asks questions. There is not a single word of confession, nor is there in the second chapter. The immediate reaction of the mourner in the book of Eicha, and we are all mourners, is one of being stunned and not understanding the ways of the Almighty. And we have a special license to seek an explanation and to ask why. We're going to be learning tonight together, and hopefully the next 15, 20 minutes, Prakim Aleph and Bet. Of course, not the entire Prakim. You could really have a very lengthy series on all and Megillat Eicha, even though it's only five Prakim. But hopefully we'll be touching on some key points in these two Prakim. What we have to understand is that the immediate reaction of someone, of a person that's lost someone, is typically the experience of shock. I knew it was coming, but I didn't expect it to be now. I knew it was coming, but I don't really understand why it had to be now. And that is the experience of Yirmiyahu in the first two prakim. The experience of Yirmiyahu, and we'll see he takes on different personas in his writing, is to ask the questions. Why? Why now? I don't understand. As opposed to giving reasons for why it took place. And so these first two prakim are really an analysis, a retelling of what exactly took place at the time, some of the questions that were asked, and the ways in which Yerushalayim feels, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and the way in which we're reflecting on the experience as to what had happened. We're going to jump right in right now into Perek Aleph. Perek Aleph is told from the perspective of Yerushalayim as a widow. And what's interesting is that for the first 11 psukim of Perek Aleph, someone, namely Yirmiyahu, is describing Yerushalayim as a widow. The person writing the keynote, namely Yirmiyahu, what's called in Hebrew the mikonein, the one that writes the kina, is describing Yerushalayim as a widow. Despaired and lonely, you see in the title. And those are mainly the two emotional experiences that Yerushalayim, a city, feels at the time. And then in Pasuk Yud Aleph, it changes into a different perspective. Yerushalayim as the widow describing her own experience. Not someone talking about her, but rather she talking about herself. And so we begin Megillat Eicha, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, Sefer Eicha, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, with I think the first three words or the first pasuk that for many of us that go to shul to hear, Eicha on Tisha B'Av night, it's very, I think, that moment where you sit down, and for many years I was in Camp Morasha, and that moment of sitting down on Tisha B'Av night and hearing kind of it being broadcast over the microphone, that I'm not going to sing it right now because there are men on the call, but I think many of us have that tune in our heads of what exactly that sounds like. Echa yashva badad. And for many of us, I know for myself, when I learned this a few days ago, it was the first time I've kind of gone back to the Sefer in this context. And that feeling of, oh my gosh, we're back here again. And I think if this is your first time looking at it since the past year, we should have that like emotional reaction a little bit. Avecha yashva badad. We're back here again. We're back here on a Tisha B'Av. We're back here 3 weeks before a Tisha B'Av, the time that we ask so many questions and difficult questions of how exactly all these catastrophes have occurred to the Jewish people over the past 2 millennia. Echa yashva badad ha'ir rabasi am haita ka'almana. How did the city, how does the city sit alone, sit solitarily? Ha'ir rabasi am, the city that was full of people, haita ka'almana. It has become like a widow. Rabasi Bagoyim, she was great amongst the nations. Not only was she full of people, was she busting at the seams, were there so many members of Klal Yisrael there? Rabasi Bagoyim, she was great amongst the nations. She had this gorgeous structure that people used to flock to. Sarati Bang, do you know she was a princess amongst the provinces? Haitalamas. She's become a tributary. I think the phrase "Haita ke'almana" is an extremely significant one, and is one we have to take a step back and think about. She was like a widow. Now, what's interesting is that Yirmiyahu does not say that she is a widow. Haita ke'almana, and the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph tells us, "Haita ke'almana, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rav, ke'almana velo almana manash." She's like a widow, but she's not actually a widow. What do we mean by that? Ela kishi isha shahalach ba'ala lamidinat hayam v'da'ato lachzor eleha. She is like a woman whose husband has gone to a country overseas, but he intends to return to her. Meaning that even in this pasuk, in this opening pasuk of Megillat Eichon, I think it's so important to recognize, there's already a hint of nechama. There's already a hint of comfort. Even as we're describing the opening pasuk of the Megillah, this city that was filled with people is now alone. The city that was so elevated amongst the other nations is now like nothing. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, this opening line is actually also a little bit of a nechama to us. That it's haitaka almana. It's not like a widow that has lost her husband forever. It's not like she is the widow, but she is like a widow. Meaning that her husband has left her, so she feels alone. But there's still the hopes of return. That whoever, and I think this is an important consideration to think about, whether she's an almana, she's a widow from Klal Yisrael, meaning Bnei Yisrael have left the city, have left Yerushalayim, or she's a widow from a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that a Kadosh Baruch Hu Shechina has been taken away with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Haitaka almana, both will return. Both Klal Yisrael eventually will return to Yerushalayim, as well as a Kadosh Baruch Hu will return to Yerushalayim. Pasuk Bet in the Megillah continues, Bacho tifke balayla, v'dimata al lechia, ein la minachim mikol ha'ayveha. These psukim are gut-wrenching. They're filled with emotion and they're extremely sad. Bacho tifke balayla, a double verb. She is crying in the night. V'dimata alechia, she has tears on her cheeks. When do we have tears on our cheeks? We have tears on our cheeks when we're crying so heavily that we can't wipe them away. Either we don't want to wipe them away, or there are so many of them because that which we're crying about is so intense that we're unable to wipe them away because they're flowing so quickly. Ein la minachim mikol ha'iveha, she has no one to comfort her from the people that loved her. Kol ro'eha bagduba, all of her friends have rebelled against her. Hayula lo'ayvim, they've become to her like enemies. Says many of the commentaries. What does it mean, ein la minachim mikol ha'iveha? All of the people that were with her, namely all of the other nations that she considered to be allies, Mitzrayim, Bavel, the Kastim, all of these other nations that she considered to be allies, they've left her. They've abandoned her. And she's alone. She has no one to defend her. She has no one to stand up for her. She has no one to comfort her from the fact that she has just experienced this extremely tragic event of destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Rav Yosef Krah explains, "Bachot tivche balayla." What does it mean that she's crying so strongly in the night? Explains, "Bechi shalu dome lezeh shebocha balayla b'sha'a she'in b'nei adam mitzuyin atzlo nachamo u'boche dima achar dima ad shedimotav dveikim lo alachim." The significance here of Bachot tivche balayla, why is she crying so heavily in the night? Because the nighttime is typically the time that people don't have others with them. It's typically the time where we don't necessarily have people with us to comfort us. If we were crying hysterically in the middle of the day in our workplace or in a school or in a shul, normally you see something like that. You walk over, you check in, are you okay? Is everything okay? But if somebody were to have that same emotional reaction at home at night in their bed, would anyone know? Would anyone be there to comfort them? Says Rav Yosef Krah, that's the type of crying we're talking about. The crying that's done at night when a person is alone, when there's no one to comfort them. The crying that's so intense that the tears stick to one's cheek. Rashi gives a different approach as to why exactly this word Laila is used. Why do we care that Yerushalayim is as if they were crying at night? Rashi says, Balaila, Shehamikdash Nisraf Balaila Da'amar Marla Eit Arif Hitzitzu Bo'edahor. Why Bachotiv Chabalayla, she's crying at night? Because that's when the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash began. The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash began at night. Chorban Beit HaMikdash began at night, said Rashi. And so therefore, Bachotiv Chabalayla, the crying begins at night. Because that's the moment that she begins to feel the pain. Rashi says, Davar Acher, why else Balayla? Balayla Layla Shabichyat Miraglin B'tishba of Garmalahim. There's a famous red medrash that's quoted at the beginning of Parshat Shlach in context of the story of the spies that go up to Eretz Yisrael. That the crying that took place at that time, that the Meraglim came back from Eretz Yisrael, told Bnei Yisrael this terrible story about Eretz Yisrael, and the reaction of Klal Yisrael at the time wasn't to say, no, Meraglim, you're wrong, and join with Yoshua and Kalev, but rather they started crying. And we're told that night, because Klal Yisrael cried, that was going to be the night that Klal Yisrael was going to cry for generations. So why Bachot Tivke Balayla? To reference that story of the Meraglim, that Tisha B'Av is a night year after year after year until the times of the ultimate Geula that we're going to cry. We're going to skip the second answer of Rashi. In Source 12, we have continuation of the description of what exactly Yerushalayim looked like at the time of the Chorban. All of her gates are desolate, as you see in the bold. Her priests sigh, her virgins are afflicted, and she herself is in bitterness. Her young children have gone into captivity because of this adversity. The experience at the time of the Chorban is described by Yirmiyahu as a time period where the gates are empty. The leadership is saddened. The virgins at the time are being afflicted, namely that they're being raped, that they're not being treated well by the men that are there. The children are being captured and taken into captivity. And the Mikonein, the writer, is looking at this scene in Yerushalayim and saying, this is what she's going through. In Source 13, in Pasuk Chet, we see Chet Chata Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has sinned, and we're not going to get into what that sin is now. We'll talk about that more next week and the following week. Chet Chata Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim has sinned Al Kein Lanida Haita. Therefore, she is like Anida. She is separated. She is separated from everyone else. Ein Menachemla, we're told again in Pasuk Tet, she still has no one to comfort her. Source 14, Re'ei Hashem v'habita ki hayiti zolela. This is the moment where it switches, where the perspective of the Mekonein switches from talking about Yerushalayim as the widow
to actually taking on the persona of Yerushalayim. And Yerushalayim turns to Hashem and says, Re'eh Hashem v'habita. Turn, God, and look at me. Ki hayiti zoleila. Look how alone, look how abject I've become, says the English translation. And so we get this picture of Yerushalayim as a city that has been completely abandoned. If you think about Yerushalayim, even in our times, Baruch Hashem, we've, I think in some ways, don't see this as much as other people in other generations have. But if we think about Yerushalayim at the time, Yerushalayim that we can even picture, of course, Yerushalayim looks very different 2,000 years ago. And we imagine those streets completely empty. And the Jews at that time being taken off to Galut, the beginning of Pasuk Yud Aleph, Kol Aman Nachem Mevakshim Lechem, people are begging for bread. It was a time of famine. It was a time of destruction. It was a time of the people leaving. And that's what we mourn. We mourn the experience of this city that once was the greatest city in the world, that had allies, that had the Shekhinah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that was filled with Klal Yisrael. Through Churban Beit HaMikdash has become alone. Pasuk Tet Zayin, I think, is one of the most powerful psukim. You put yourself in Yerushalayim's shoes. In Yerushalayim's shoes, having seen the glory of what she could be. Al Ela Ani Bochia, over all this I cry, Eini, Eini, Yorda Mayim. Again, a mention of tears. My eyes, they're flowing with water. Ki rachak mi meni menachim. Again, because I have no one to come for me. This phrase was a little bit different above. Ein menachim la, and a little bit different even above over here. Ein la menachim. Again, we have this phrase. Ki rachak mi meni menachim. I have no one to come for me. I am completely alone. The Alsha commenting on this pasuk tells us, rak im al eila ani bochia. I'm crying about this. V'lo al shfichot dam, I'm not about the death. What does the Alshik say? What is Yerushalayim really crying about? Rak al ki bayom hahu rachak mimeni menachim hi hashchina ki nistalak. Says the Alshik, Yerushalayim, taking the place, really, I think, in many ways, of Klal Yisrael, of Yirmiyahu, but I'm expressing the emotions of the time. There was an extreme feeling that I don't want to come for me, whether it's my allies or whether it's Shechina HaKadosh Baruch. The Shechina of Hashem has left, so I have no one to comfort me. The parak concludes with Tavo Kol Ra'atam Lefanecha. Yerushalayim asks for revenge, I would say. Not in an extremely strong way, but rather all of the wickedness that her enemy has performed, she wants them to be brought up to Hashem, for Hashem to look at them and see, let it all come. Va'olel lamo kasher lo'alta li al kol pesha'i ki rabot an choti v'li bitavai. Let it all come before you, Kadosh Baruch Hu, so that you can impact them as I desire and for all of my transgressions. Rav Yosef Kra explains, Ki rabot an choti v'libi davai, what does that mean? That my pain is strong and my heart is aching. He says, B'nohik she'be'olam adam ko'ev be'achad me'ivarav, ein sha'ar ivarav margishim be'ko'avim kol kach. That if one person's part of his leg is hurting, then the rest of his limbs don't necessarily hurt. Right? I know my son came home from camp today and said, Mommy, my arm is hurting me. But he was able to walk. He was able to walk around. He was able to raise the other arm. He was able to use his mouth. It wasn't like every other body part was bothering him. Mommy, my arm is hurting. Aval kishahalev dava, kol aguf dava. When the heart hurts, the rest of the body hurts. The ain ke'ev ke'ev halev. And there's nothing worse. There's no hurt worse than the heart of one's heart. And I think in many ways of a broken heart. And so Perek Aleph concludes, because my sighs are many and my heart is faint. The heart is faint because the heart experiences all of the pain. When the heart is in pain, when a person is emotionally distraught, when a person has heartbreak, the rest of the body experiences it too. And so Yerushalayim, reflecting on her experience, reflecting on all of the difficult things, the fact that she is now alone, looks back and says, it hurts. It's all encompassing. This has completely overtaken me. I think we're going to stop here for tonight. We'll pick up with Perek Bet next week. I know the hour is late. But what I want to conclude with is this perspective that we got from Rav Soloveitchik at the beginning, the understanding that in many ways, we have the ability to throw ourselves into a Tisha B'Av. We have the ability to throw ourselves into a Tisha B'Av in 3 weeks from now to be able to, Be'ezer Hashem, we won't have this Tisha B'Av, we'll be in Yerushalayim celebrating together. But we have the power to throw ourselves into a Tisha B'Av and to use that moment to ask the Kadosh Baruch Hu these questions of why that we might not be able to ask at any other point in the year. And the reason for that is because Yirmiyahu in Sefer Eicha laid out for us the way that we do that. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we see how Yirmiyahu was asking those questions. As we mentioned in the beginning of this, that in these first two prakim, one of which we saw tonight, one of which we'll see Be'ezrat Hashem next week, Yirmiyahu is just reflecting as a mourner. This is what's going on. This is what's going on in my surroundings. This is how Yerushalayim feels. These are Yerushalayim's reflections on what's taking place. I'm alone. I'm desolate. I have no one to comfort me. And she's crying out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu over that. And I think ending with this Maharikra tonight, what we have to think about is the recognition that in 3 weeks from now, we're supposed to put ourselves back in that place. We're supposed to put ourselves back in that place where we also feel Ki Rabot en Chativa Libi Davai. Where we also feel that pain of tragedy, of suffering, of catastrophe that started 2 millennia ago and continues today. I think many of us, I was talking to my husband about this before, and with this we'll conclude, feel like we may have experienced more catastrophe and suffering in the past few months than we have in a while. And I think on the one hand, it allows this Tisha B'Av to be a little bit more meaningful. But on the other hand, it pushes us even more so to think about our perspective, not only in relation to us in this time, but also in relation to the 2,000 years, and even more than that, of Jews that have suffered and struggled because of Korban Bayit Rishon. And through, hopefully, our learning together over the upcoming few weeks, we'll have the ability to really understand why this is such a significant moment. And we'll have the ability to prepare ourselves to be in that place on Tisha B'Av night where when we hear those words of Eicha Yashva Badad Ha'ira Basiyam Haitala Ka'almana, we'll be able to say, wow, what a horrible, horrible experience. And we'll be able to ask those questions as to why in the way that Yirmiyahu does as well. Wishing all of you an easy and meaningful fast that begins tomorrow night, and one that begins a process for all of us over the next 3 weeks. Rav Soloveitchik has an approach about Avilas Yeshana versus Avilas Chadasha. For many articles on Yud Torah, you can go and research and look up what exactly that is. But we have to prepare ourselves for this moment of Tisha B'Av, and hopefully this assisted us in that process and began us thinking about what this mourning is all about, and what we are actually mourning. A city that was once filled with people has become desolate and set us on a trajectory leading to many, many years of difficulties in Jewish history. Wishing all of you a good night. Thank you so much again, and hopefully see many of you next week.
Thank you, Mrs. Bernstein, and thank you everyone for joining us. Everyone have a wonderful evening.